Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, a way you can have some fun with us on Facebook today. Where were you when the lights went out 10 years ago this afternoon? We're collecting your blackout of 2003 memories on Facebook. Was it the most fun you've ever had, as I think it was for some people? Or was it a lot of work and a lot of hardship? Share your blackout story with us on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/BrianLehrerWNYC. Joining me now is David McCraney, self-described psychology nerd. You might remember him from his previous book, You Are Not So Smart, and we had him on the show for that. Now he's the author of You Are Now Less Dumb, How to Conquer Mob Mentality, How to Buy Happiness, and all the other ways to outsmart yourself. Hey, David, welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, wow, it's great to be back. Thank you.
So that part of the subtitle, How to Buy Happiness, I thought we couldn't do that. What do you mean?
The research suggests that after a certain point, you can't buy happiness. But having not so much money versus having a comfortable amount of money, there is a big difference. But according to several studies into this, above $75,000 a year on average in the modern United States, the happiness day-to-day plateaus. And so that means a person who has $1 million or $10 million in the bank, day-to-day, their daily life is no really happier than a person who has about $75,000. It makes about $75,000 a year because it's about being able to, go to a movie or a restaurant, or it's about not having want more than it is about having excess. And excess does not make us happier, at least not material excess.
So poverty stinks. We can stipulate that without being very sophisticated about psychology, right?
True. Yes, definitely. And any material object you purchase, even a house or a car or land, that stuff loses its luster very quickly if it doesn't provide you experiences. And there's a great book just about that one particular topic called Happy Money. But in my book, I write mainly about what happens when you try to when you add money to something that you already love. It can sap your love of the thing that you're doing. So a job or a community service or when you're volunteering maybe for something that you really believe in, those things can lose their luster the second that you add financial gain to those things.
Hmm. All right. So you list all these myths in your book that we believe about the way we think, and I'm going to try to get through at least four of these. Number one, you write about the backfire effect. It's the reason why people who doubt President Obama was born in this country, for example, will never accept evidence that he was. Tell us more about the backfire effect.
Okay, so hopefully most people have heard of confirmation bias at this point, and I wrote about that a lot in the first book. And if you need a refresher, confirmation bias is our tendency to pay more attention to things that confirm our preconceived notions and less attention to things that do not. But sort of it's also we're not very good at noticing that we're doing that all the time, and we believe we have this mountain of evidence that favors our preconceived notions, and really we haven't been paying attention to disconfirmation. With the backfire effect, this is something that's very new. It's a very new research that's just now being unraveled. And in the research, what happens is they show someone a news story that matches their preconceived notions, and it could sometimes the stories are completely fake just to make sure that it matches the person's preconceived notions. And so if a person leans very left, they'll read a story that confirms a belief that's very left-leaning and vice versa for right-leaning. And then they present that person with a correction to the first story, saying, sorry, the story you just read is not actually true. Here's the latest information. I'm sorry, the first report was false. And so they have people judge both before and after they receive the correction how much faith they have that the reporting was accurate. And they find that after a person learns that a story that originally supported their ideal system is incorrect, they tend to believe in it even more strongly. After they learn that it's incorrect, they believe it's even in that thing even more strongly than before. So corrections tend to deepen a person's resolve that they were right to begin with, even when the corrections are included in the story in line. And if you're reading it, and as you're reading it, you see off to the side, it says, this has already been corrected, sorry, this has already been corrected, sorry. And I talk about how that is another reason you should never get into arguments on Facebook with your uncle who thinks, you know, Obama is in the secret Muslim Illuminati. Like, you're not going to convince them otherwise, no matter how deep you search into Google and bring up facts. They're going to do the same thing, and you're both just making each other feel more deeply, more strongly in your original conviction.
Is this related to another of the myths you bring up in the book, the common belief fallacy, the misconception that the larger the consensus, the more likely it is correct?
Yeah, you know, when we're faced, it's a good tendency. Like everything else I write about in both books, everything, all these self-delusions are adaptive. Over our long evolutionary history, they've served us well, and they've served us, they've been good for us more than they've been bad for us, but we don't necessarily find ourselves in the sort of situations that we adapted these responses to deal with. And with the common belief fallacy, if you're in a new environment and you are unfamiliar with how things are working and you need to gather as much information as possible, you'll tend to go with a consensus. But not every consensus is worth going in line with if it isn't brought about using the scientific toolkit. And the best part of the scientific method is that it seeks disconfirmation, like we were talking about earlier with confirmation bias, which is something that we don't naturally do. And if you're looking at a consensus that was derived without seeking disconfirmation, you can't really trust it. And I use as an example the pervasive belief in South Korea in oscillating fan death, that if you find yourself in a room with a desk fan and the windows and doors are closed, then you might just die. It's such a commonly held belief that fans there have a safety switch that turns them off after a certain period of time. And it's, you know, it's 2013. This is a country of people who can easily debunk this, but it's a belief that persists. And we have similar beliefs in our culture as well.
My guest on WNYC, David McCraney, author of You Are Now Less Dumb, How to Conquer Mob Mentality, How to Buy Happiness. And we're talking about some of the ways that we are outsmarted by our own brains. We're trying to go through at least four of these. And let's do another one that you call the illusion of asymmetric insight. What's that?
The illusion of asymmetric insight is the natural tendency for all normal people with a normal brain to sort of see everyone, see yourself as an iceberg, and that there's a lot of depth beneath the surface, and to see other people as having most of that iceberg above the surface. So we believe that there is more to us than meets the eye, but we don't really intuitively see that in other people. We believe that other people are much easier to assess and understand, that we see through them and all their tricks and their smoke and mirrors. And we also do that for groups. We believe the groups to which that we belong to, we believe that they are nuanced and difficult and complex, but the groups that we feel are in opposition to our beliefs are easy to understand, and that they're simple. And the people, we tend to believe that people on the other side are deluding themselves, and we're never deluding ourselves. And what that I talk about in the book, research that today would be so unethical they would never do it, but it was the research in which they had groups of children form societies in a social vacuum, and they found that those societies would come up with all these norms and rituals and ways that they should talk to each other and the ways that they should conduct their behavior during meals and everything. And then they allow those two groups to meet each other for the first time. And, of course, they immediately believe that every belief, custom, and ritual that the other team or the other group possessed was awful and terrible and silly and stupid. And it's sort of a natural human tendency that we'll form groups and then we'll also think that the other group is silly. And we'll find it difficult to see a reflection of ourselves in another group and find it difficult to believe that other people see themselves the way that we see ourselves.
Do you think we see this on Facebook? We were actually talking about something related in our last segment, which was a political segment, but this urge to unfriend people who post opinions we don't agree with because they can't possibly be as informed as we are, and we bury ourselves in networks of like-minded people?
I think that is the new skill set that we need to gain and learn how to operate our own brains in this new environment, which is the mountain and the overflow of information that we can get to at a moment's notice, because It's sort of confirmation bias and all the many other biases and fallacies that go along with it are sort of like an invasive species that in the previous environment, before it was so easy to get online and find confirmation of your beliefs, it sort of was kept in check by the natural forces of that era, those eras. But now, in this new environment, if I believe that people didn't land on the moon, it's very easy for me to get online and find confirmation for that and find groups of people that meet and talk about it. So there's a new skill set that's required when you have access to all the information that's ever been, both good and bad. And the way that our brains currently operate, without knowing that you have these tendencies, it's easy to fall into really erroneous belief systems.
I noticed in that chapter, though, and I think this is so interesting, you write that people who claim to know a complicated topic very well, let's say, for example, cap and trade, become more moderate in their opinions once they're asked to explain the issue to others. How does that work?
Yeah, it's very recent research showed that when a person, like flat taxes and, credit default swaps, these things that no one truly actually fully understands 100%, people, and especially if that bleeds over into a political opinion, you know, some sort of libertarian or deeply strongly aggressive political opinion you might have about any topic, the zealotry that a person experiences when they start arguing about a topic like that will be very dampened and subdued if you just ask the person to fully explain themselves. I think I write that it saps the fervor of the argument because it's difficult to justify your position when you start to realize that you don't really understand all the nuances of it. In every human, in every cognition, we tend to think that we tend to take very complex issues and boil them down into very small, simple ideas, mostly emotional concepts. And then we believe that since we understand that very simple to understand concept, that we understand the more complex concept. But when you're faced against the facts and you realize that no, you don't actually understand as fully as you did before, it brings that zealotry and fervor down, and it really brings the conversation to something more civil.
So how does anybody ever change their minds?
Well, it's tough. It takes a long time. I think that it's not something that happens in one argument. It doesn't happen in one book that you read or one news story. It has to slowly erode over a period of months and years after exposure to not just raw information, but also to other people living different lives who see things differently, and you have different viewpoints, and you start to understand nuance. The worst thing you can do is think that the world is simple. And the deeper and more complex you see real problems, the more you realize that your opinions may have been based off something very, very small and tiny and simple and easy to understand, and you'll need to alter your viewpoint.
Four ways our brains fool us. Number four, we have about 30 seconds for this final one, what you call the no true Scotsman fallacy. What is it?
As a person who has lived a long time in the South, whenever you see someone on television who says the tornado just destroyed my house, and they start and they look silly on television, and you wish that they weren't from where you live, you'll say that, well, that's not really the kind of people who live here. But usually that's not so true. Just the no true Scotsman fallacy is whenever a person sees an example of a person in their group do something they'd rather them not, and then they start to take that person and say, they never were in that group to begin with. They're not a true member of my group, and it makes you feel better about the groups that you belong to.
All right. Well, there are four ways our brains fool us. There are a lot more in the new book, You Are Now Less Dumb, How to Conquer Mob Mentality, How to Buy Happiness, and All the Other Ways to Outsmart Yourself, by David McCraney, who has been our guest. Very illuminating. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.